A very warm welcome to another edition of Czech Books, and this week we're in a cafe in a beautiful part of the Lesser Quarter of Prague, and I'm joined by Tomáš Sedláček, who is, unlike most of the people we talk to in Czech Books, an economist. In fact, he's chief economic strategist for one of the major Czech banks. But we're not going to be talking about numbers. We're here to talk about his new book, which has just come out and has attracted a great deal of attention in the Czech Republic. It's called Ekonomie dobrá a zlá. In English, it could translate as The Economics of Good and Evil. Well, I'll start with a quote to try and give you an idea of the subject of this book. This is from right at the beginning of the book. Initially, people explained the world around them through myths and religion. Today this role is played by science. It would be foolish to think that economic thinking didn't begin until the scientific age. In order to understand the economic thinking of our distant ancestors, we need to steep ourselves in their myths and philosophy. That is the aim of this book. And so, Tomáš, I suppose to put it simply, you're trying to take economics out of the box and to say that economics isn't just about number crunching, but it's connected with many other different aspects of our lives.
Yes, well, economics is a beautiful area. It's mainly to do with the way we humans behave and which we relate to each other. And I always was looking for mirrors because the only way you can look a little bit out of the box to get out of the box, and that is, of course, difficult, and it is rarely to be done without some external aid. And I use as an aid, you know, the old tales from the Old Testament or from Mesopotamia, and these people were dealing with exactly or very similar to the issues that we're dealing with today. We use mathematics mainly today and scientific rigorous approach to explain the world around us, and they explained the very same world using stories and fables and actually very beautiful way of describing how we relate to each other. So I've not put a single number in this book. Even the pages are actually numbered backwards. So it starts with -368, I think, and then it goes to the end, just to, you know, bring the point across that numbers is something that's created by our society. It is a construct, a product that can serve us and should serve us, but sometimes it also binds us. And if the only way that we can look around is through numbers and through statistics, and that sometimes is helpful, but sometimes it isn't helpful and can be misleading.
And I must say, as someone who doesn't really understand economics, I was very much gripped when I started reading the book, and I was fascinated by some of the parallels that you drew. For example, there's one point where you, I think slightly with tongue-in-cheek, you describe Joseph in the Old Testament as the first Keynesian, when the Pharaoh asks Joseph to interpret his dream, and it's the dream about the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. Joseph gives him the sound Keynesian advice that during the 7 years of plenty, he should stock up with grain for the 7 years of famine, which he consequently does. Good, sound economic advice, and this is from the Old Testament.
It's a very interesting story. It is the first ever recorded business cycle, so to speak, in the history of mankind. And the story has a lot to say to us. First of all, we don't hear why the cycle happened. There is no explanation in the Bible. It just happened. Secondly, the Pharaoh saw the future in dreams. Now, this is today expected of economists to see the future, to say when the crisis will come and when it will be over. Now, we don't have these dreams anymore. We don't look for reality or for the future in dreams or in visions as the Asians did. Now, we look in statistical models and we can see that they didn't help us very much, not in this case. And I then fast forward the story to this age. And we also, as mankind or as our civilization, or the Western civilization, as we like to refer to ourselves, we also had very good 7 years of plenty from the year 2001 till the year 2007, 2008. It's been very good 7 years, and we've not stocked up anything. We've actually indebted our civilization even more and even further. So despite the fact that this is a very Asian story, thousands of years old, or we should have actually learned something, we haven't, and we've actually been foolish, and we've not stocked up any grain. On the contrary, the storehouses are empty after the 7 years of plenty that our civilization has had. And not only that, they're full of IOUs, you know, lying on the table. And so I like to take these stories out and say, listen, this is a story that every child can understand. This is a story that we tell to our children before they go to sleep. And yet our super duper economic models have, you know, produced a situation in which even a small child could see a much wiser solution than what we've actually chosen as a civilization.
And you put it rather nicely in the book. I'll quote again. If modern economics feels confident to explain the way churches function, or to carry out an economic analysis of family relationships, often offering new and interesting insights, why shouldn't we also look at theoretical economics in the way that we look at a system of religious or private relationships? In other words, why not try looking at economics from an anthropological point of view? So just what you're saying, turning economics on its head and actually saying, what can the way that we see the world, the way that we tell stories, as you say, tell us about economics? This is something that really has been neglected by economists in recent years, isn't it? There has been a tendency more and more to see economics as a science.
If we want to interpret the world, we ask the economists, what's happening? What is to come? We ask the physicists. We ask the scientists. Now, science also believes in something. We have our 10 commandments. We have our belief system. We economists must believe in rationality. We must believe in egoism. Once you question that, a fatwa is almost placed on your head. You no longer are an appropriate economist. So we have these sets of beliefs that nobody really understands. I mean, if you look in theoretical physics, we believe something that we don't understand. And it's an interesting thing. If you speak to theoretical physicists and you ask them how much of the reality around us can you actually explain, they will say, well, around 5 to 7%. I mean, the rest of that is still embedded in mystery. But we kind of believe that we understand what's happening around us, and we don't. The only thing that we can predict is the things that are predictable, which are exactly the things that we don't care about. We want to know the unpredictable things. And this crisis is a good example of how we can predict only things that follow the same pattern that they followed in the past. And this is something that I try to point this fact out, that we shouldn't think that we are wiser or in any way more educated than the ones that were here before us.
I was fascinated when I read the concluding few pages of your book, that you really put quite a passionate case for bringing ethics, I suppose, to put it simply, back into economics. Could you maybe expand a little bit on what you're trying to say as the message of the book?
Well, you know, economists are believed to be the ones who have no values. They're value-free, so to speak. And then we are expected to give absolutely value-free advice. Now, this is very rarely the case. All economists are believers in something. They might be believers in free market. They may be believers in regulated market. That is a concern of each individual. My point here is that if you don't admit this, you're not really going to get very far, because you have a choice of a school, a choice of a model, and that model you choose according to the results that you really want to see. So if you believe in globalization and free market, you choose the models that are appropriate, and then you arrive, abracadabra, you arrive to the very same conclusion that you entered into text. So if we pretend that we are, you know, value-free science, but we're not really, then that can lead to a great mismatch. And secondly, economists are confronted with the question, what are we to do? And that is a ethical question. And this is something that we economists have avoided in the past 100 years. I mean, the word ethics has become a bad word, a root word. Yet, economics has started as an ethical discourse. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. David Hume, Thomas Malthus, and others were chiefly moral philosophers. And this is where economics was born. And today we try to get away from this cradle, from this origin of the discourse. And it can lead to very dangerous situations.
One concept that you criticize repeatedly in the book is the idea of the so-called invisible hand of the market. This is an expression that is in the Czech Republic again and again associated with the Czech president, Václav Klaus, who is himself an economist. And he loves to come back to the idea that the economy is what drives pretty much everything in society. This is obviously something that's highly controversial, and you do polemicize with it. But I noticed that you never mentioned Mr. Klaus's name. Is he a kind of hidden adversary in your book?
He is a representative, a political representative of a very popular reading of economy as a solution to everything. I mean, all problems and all riddles of the world will be solved if we apply our method. In this, economists have become the priests of a new era, the priests of abundance, the priests of efficiency, the priests of a golden age that is to come if we all follow our advice. And I don't directly polemicize with anybody in the book. I polemicize with the idea that economy is something that is the modus vivendi of our age.
Your name has been brought up as a possible future finance minister in the Czech Republic. Do you have any political ambitions?
Well, I've turned it down after 2 days of thinking. And in my life, I've always worked very closely to politics, but I've never been a member of any political party. I value more influence than power. And if I can influence a good decision in a politician, then that is my day. I don't necessarily need to be the one who, you know, puts the stamp or, you know, takes the cream out of the pot. So if any politician is interested, I'd be very happy to offer advice, but I don't want to myself become one, not yet. I think I'm also too young for that.
Yes, I mean, that's a point I was going to make. You're still only 32, so
yes,
you've got a long career ahead of you, I hope. Which brings me to my very final question. This book has caused quite a stir. It's been talked about a lot. What's your next book going to be about?
I don't know. I've just finished. This one came out, I think, 3 months ago. Now it's being translated into English, German, Italian, Polish. There's many translations that are on the way. None of them yet finalized because this is still a new book. But when I'm falling asleep and I'm thinking maybe 2-3 years down the line, I was thinking of writing a selection of essays reflecting, for example, the topic of adventure, which is something that our society lacks. That's why we buy it in movies and in cinemas, and we kind of buy artificial danger because we lack the real danger. And I have already 12 topics selected like that, on friendship, on utility, on growth, and on a newest one that I was thinking about is artificial wealth. How much of our wealth is actually artificial today? How much of that is debt driven from future generations? How much of our wealth is now driving on resources that we're stealing from the future that we really have no right to use? And I haven't done the calculations so far, but I guess the percentage will be quite high.
Tomáš Sedláček, thank you very much for talking to us on Radio Prague.
Thank you very much for having me.